Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the Fin Fang Foom to my Puff the Magic Dragon. It's Dan. You didn't know that one was coming, huh?
Nope. I hadn't quite figured it out. So.
And also to explain to about 98% of our listening audience, while you guys have probably heard of Puff the Magic Dragon, Fin Fang Foom is actually a Marvel Comics character for the last few decades who, you know, was basically an alien dragon, but who cares? It's that name. I mean, Fin Fang Foom. You don't get much more fun than that. So we are here this evening to discuss the season, or I guess we should say, it hurts to say it, the series finale of Hannibal. I watched it, obviously, the night of, very slowly, trying to savor it like a glass of wine or something. You weren't able to catch it till the next day because you work crazy hours and such. So you might actually have a fresher opinion of it than I do. So before we even get into all the recapping and all our little facts and fun about the episode, I thought we should lead off right up, you know, with our actual opinions, at least in a minor way, and we'll talk more during the course of the podcast. So what did you think of it overall?
I liked it. I had reasonably high expectations just going in, because, you know, the second half of the season has been really strong, and I hadn't been spoiled at all. I mean, it's the kind of show where, like, you know, it's one of the top shows that I, you know, really, really like, but I just, instead of pushing my, you know, skipping sleep last night, I decided just, you know, wait, because, I mean, there wasn't much chance of me getting spoiled if, like, 5,000 people watch the show. You know, it's not like Game of Thrones where, like, you know, 500 people are going to be tweeting, you know, bloop, bloop, got killed, like, 1 second after it happened, so.
Right, right.
So I was able to make it through the day unscathed, and it definitely got the job done, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think we actually, in a weird way, we kind of lucked out by NBC's total lack of promotion for the show, because we had not even seen any scenes from it or flashes of it, like in a little, even in a 15-second teaser from last week. And fortunately, although, from what I understand, some folks outside the U.S., I think, like, say, in Canada, actually got to see the episode a couple days earlier. Fortunately, and probably like you say, because there's really not that many of them, nobody spoiled anything for us, like on our Facebook page or elsewhere, because, as I've said in previous podcasts, the more I realize they're diverging from the book, the more I realize I actually don't know how this is going to wrap up, which excited me, and which was actually the case with this episode. I would say once we got past the first 5 minutes, we were in semi to completely new territory for the rest of the episode. So I could honestly say I did not know what was going to happen as far as, you know, well, I'm a book guy or something. So I was just like everyone else, just, you know, tension ridden, wondering what was going to happen in the next scene, the next act, and so on. And as the hour grew near, you know, of it being over, I was like, oh, how are they going to end this? And, well, we'll get into all that as we go through the podcast. But I could not have probably been more pleased with this unless they had suddenly had a scroll at the bottom of the screen letting us know that it was all a big stupid joke and they actually are going to have a season 4 even on this horrible network. But that did, obviously, that was one surprise we didn't get, unfortunately.
It'd be funny if they had a, you know, their way of, like, announcing the show was coming back with just having, like, Hannibal, like, going on some kind of rampage through, you know, whatever NBC's headquarters is, and just massacring people.
Well, they should have, a Zelig-like thing where Hannibal just starts to appear on all the other NBC shows, and actually, that's not really Hannibal's style, since he's more the manipulator, so maybe we can, you know, maybe if Francis Dolaride can just be resuscitated for a little while, he can go on, since he clearly can take out gazillions of people, which I never knew he was really that lethal a force. He was like John Wick on the street. you know, shooting right and left. You know, it's like, could you wipe out everyone on the blacklist and maybe a few of the Heroes Reborn? Let's kill all them too while you're at it. Anyway, seems like we're rambling from the start. So I guess maybe it's time we get to the episode, which was, the title was The Wrath of the Lamb. And as we open the episode, we are back with Reba and Francis Dolarhyde. And I guess I just misunderstood things last week. So the house that they're in, I think, actually is Francis Dolarhyde's house that he had been in before. I just didn't put that together last week. So once again, yeah. I didn't quite get that at first. But, you know, let's face it, we had never gotten such an elaborate exterior of his house before. Hence,
no, I don't think they had any exterior shots. They just pretty much everything was just, you know, showing the attic and then whatever, you know.
Right. But if I had, you know, half the brains I claim to, I would have realized, well, he's got this really interesting attic. So obviously he lives in a house of some kind, you know, and we've seen the interior with these staircases. So it's got to be a couple stories. Oh, that's probably his house. But, you know, I'm stupid. In any case, he is with Reba and he's, you know, trying to keep her calm, although he's not really, you know, the calming type exactly. He wants her to feel for this key that he has around his neck, and he makes sure that she's aware of the layout of the house. And because he wants her to go downstairs, and with that key, and I love that it's like an old-timey kind of a key, you know, kind of key that no one really uses for anything in the last, I don't know, 100 years. He wants her to go downstairs and lock the door, and he does warn her, you know, don't try to run because I'll catch you. So she toddles off downstairs, but of course she does actually try to do that, you know, open the door and he's there. And I kept thinking, that's not the smartest thing to do because, you know, you're blind, so I'm not really sure how far you're going to get. I mean, I'm betting you're going to trip within at least 5 to 10 feet of the front of that door, but okay. So he has her put the key back around his neck, you know, make sure the door is locked, and they return to the bedroom. Now, when he's in the bedroom with her, he warns her to sit still, otherwise he won't be able to keep him off you. So it's interesting, he's again talking about the Great Red Dragon, and he's kind of in that separation of personalities mode, where it's like Francis Dolarhyde's personality is trying to control or at least suppress his dragon nature. He does have her feel his shotgun, which, you know, isn't even remotely phallic, you know. especially when he said, I wanted to trust you, you felt so good. Then you realize he's not going to kill her. And I think I'm pretty sure most people knew what was about to happen here, unless they have no familiarity with any previous version. But he basically starts pouring gasoline all around the room. And I'm thinking Reba, blind or not, she probably can smell the gasoline and probably knows what's about to happen, especially when he lights a match. So, you know, the room, you know, erupts in flame. And that's when he says that he can't stand to watch her burn. We see the shotgun move, and then with Reba, we hear the blast, and she gets a bit of a spatter on her. And then we're treated to one of the more graphic POVs that we've gotten on the series. We're looking right through the gaping hole in the head of what we're supposed to think is Francis Dolarhyde. But I'm going to say that practically everyone watching the episode knows that's not him.
No, I actually thought it was him until, like, you know, the opening, until the next scene started rolling. Then I was like, oh, I guess it probably isn't actually dead. But
yeah, that would be kind of a buzzkill. Like, we build to this, you know, final episode with this bad guy, and then he kills him in 3 minutes. I think all I was trying to figure out, I was like, wait, who did he find? What poor soul did he already kill?
Yeah, I was trying to little... I was trying to think, just like, is there another character that he would have killed? And then they explain it later. No, yeah, and then I was wondering, like, wouldn't Reba smell like the, you know, smell a dead body and just, you know, no, but maybe, you know, I guess those gasoline's a strong smell, but, you know, she has, right, like, she has super acute senses, like Matt Murdock, so I just figured.
Yeah. Well, we've already established in the previous episode, she's no daredevil. If she couldn't smell the fear of Chilton just a few feet away, then she's not going to be able to distinguish one head, you know, pile of head goo from another, quite frankly. Because she does have to feel around the remains of that head for the key. And then under a blanket, she makes her way out of the inferno. You know, as they're showing the house burning, I like that there's that brief moment where we see that mounted deer on fire. Yeah. I just thought, is that like a little nod to that frequently seen the Patronus of Hannibal, I like to call it, the stag. I feel it had to be, because why else would you put that in there?
Yeah, definitely.
So when we come back from the credits, we get a scene with Will and Reba, and it's a nice little scene between the two of them, because she's obviously traumatized by what happened, you know, and she keeps recounting over and over, you know, putting her hand in what was left of his face. You know, but I like that, you know, despite being traumatized, and even this little wisecrack she makes about herself being a charmer, she's still strong. You know, even it doesn't matter that Will doesn't even need to point out to her that, you know, Dolarhyde didn't kill her, that her influence most likely led to him wanting to stop, and probably ended up saving lives. I like that he refers to him, you know, he's not a freak, because she mentions how she attracts freaks, and hasn't every other woman said that at one point in her life, I think. And I like that Will actually says, no, he wasn't a freak. He was a man with a freak on his back. Now, what's interesting is that Will saw the film when he attacked Chilton. So he saw that huge tattoo. So you could say, you know, literally there's this freakish thing on his back. But I guess he's more doing the monkey on the back kind of analogy here, I suppose.
Yeah.
That scene kind of closed with the acknowledgement of there being a similarity between the two of them, which I had never thought of before, that they both attract people who not only foster dependency, but actually feed upon it. Which means we're now going to get a scene between Will and Hannibal Lecter. So we get another trip to, I guess, Lecter's memory palace. And Will, I wouldn't say if he's in good spirits, but he does have enough of a sense of humor to say, "Ding dong, the dragon's dead." And I like that Lecter asks him if, you know, if congratulations are in order. And when Will tells him, you know, what had happened, you know, Lecter's response is, you know that it's a shame that he came all this way and he didn't get to kill anybody. But he notes that, you know, there is a consolation about Dr. Chilton. So he congratulates him for the job that he did on him, because he admired it so much. So the rest of this plays out, you know, Lecter doing his typical trying to get under Will's skin, because he not so subtly tries to put the responsibility of what happened to Chilton at his feet. That doesn't seem to work. But then Hannibal tries this other tack, because when Will expresses his desire to, you know, resume his life with his wife and stepson, Hannibal does point out to him that it's never going to be the same now. I think he has a nice line where the unwanted knowledge will live with you like unwanted company in the house. Basically, he's implying that Will has a lot more fun with him than he ever has with his wife. At least that's what the way he sounds here, especially when he says, you know, think about me when he's walking away. And that's kind of what kind of sets Will off. And I like that Will shows a bit more of a spine here with him when he tells him that, you know, you turned yourself in so I'd always knew where you were. You know, the only reason you would do that is if I rejected you, you know, goodbye. And he kind of walks off, even when, you know, Hannibal's still trying to get to him. And you can see that's the first time that Hannibal's been, he gets even slightly emotionally affected by Will. And he asks, you know, was it good to see me? And he's like, good? No. So Will returns to the motel, and he's immediately attacked by Francis Dolarhyde. who also chloroforms him. So now we're in totally, I don't know where they're going territory, but I'm intrigued by it. And Dalaran awakens Will by splashing water on him, which, you know, it's a lot better than the accelerants that he tends to splash around. But after some back and forth, it becomes clear that they both feel, or at least they both claim to feel, betrayed by Hannibal Lecter. And after establishing that Dalaran did not change, aka kill, Reba, because he's stronger than the dragon now, Will actually goes as far to say that Lecter is the one he should, you know, change, which means kill. And after, like, you know, Dalaran kind of ponders how he would actually be able to see Lecter, they share this little conspiratorial evil look, and I was like, okay, this... I'm not sure if this is exactly how I thought they were going to play this out, but that's kind of interesting. But I was really, at this point, excited, because I was like, oh, this is so different than anything I'd expected before. And I kept thinking, the delight I'm feeling, it's kind of like Lecter hearing about a charbroiled Chilton. You know, I was like, And speaking of delights, we then pay a visit with our favorite CSI boys, Price and Zeller. I'm glad we actually got a scene with them in the episode. This may be one of the few, although there's actually a few funny moments in the episode, but this is played more for pure comedy than any other scene. Did you get a kick out of them?
Yeah.
Not so much talking about the teeth, but actually reenacting the crime. I kept thinking, could they really just spin them off and NBC can have their own little CSI show with these guys? And then even keep Jack Crawford around so that way he actually has something to do for a change. But he doesn't really have much to do in this half of the season, does he? Mm. But I guess the important thing about the scene is the revelation that, you know, they're standing over that crispy corpse. They've already figured out that this is not Dalaran. That's when we find out it's, I don't know, some poor schmuck who worked at a local service station or something. So, which I don't know if we ever saw another character that they could be referring to. So, you know, it's a shame. Yeah, I don't remember that. You know who I was hoping it could have been? I was hoping that maybe if they mentioned they never found him or something, it could have been the guy that he shot when he was going after Molly. But I guess he would be kind of decaying and moldy by now. I don't know. The guy who got killed and no one seemed to care about. Ah, poor guy. But they definitely hypothesized that Dalaran did all this and set it up to trick his blind girlfriend, which, you know, pretty much makes sense. But then as the camera moves back, because it's not for a few minutes into the scene where we realize, oh, Will is there. And by seeing Will there, that confirms that, oh, he's got to be in cahoots with Dalaran now. Especially when he then tells Jack that there might be someone who would be even better bait to catch Dalaran than himself, Lecter. Now, this will be the first of wanting to call out characters a little bit. Jack's first reaction is, why would anyone want to meet Hannibal Lecter? Okay, number one, dude, you are aware of the calls and correspondence between these two, so you kind of would think you'd want to meet him. Not to mention, you work around and deal with serial killers. You don't know that there are probably millions of people who are fascinated and obsessed with serial killers? You know, you might as well say, why would anyone want to meet Charles Manson? You know what? A lot of people would. So, anyway, there is this one moment here, which kind of comes and goes, where Jack actually seems to find it odd that Will is so sure of himself at this plan. So, you know, Will kind of backpedals a little bit. But for that split second, I was thinking, oh, are they trying to imply that Jack might have an inkling of what Will's up to? But I don't know if that ever, you know, manifests, except maybe the look on Jack's face later on in the post debacle on the road. You know, I'm not sure. But then Jack kind of starts to lay out the plan of how to do this, that they fake an escape. Now, right there, right off the bat, Jack, if if Jack was actually a really good FBI agent, said, no, we can't do that. Have you met Hannibal Lecter? Do you think that's a good idea? And it's right at that point they cut to the rather shaken and even shocked look on Bedelia's face. Because, you know what? She's really not cool with this plan. Because up until this moment, I think she felt, you know, she was kind of living a risk-free life. Because, you know, the guy who was pretty, you know, wants to kill her and eat her was under lock and key. And now they're going to maybe fake let him out. And she knows what he's capable of, as should they all. Plus, she's probably aware that plans that Will and Jack tend to come up with don't seem to work out so well, you know. So these are people who don't seem to learn from history very well. But what's a lot of fun is this really rather vicious, I would even say, back and forth between Will and Bedelia. I think in previous scenes, there tended to be this kind of bitchy jealousy between them, you know, over Hannibal, I guess. But now it's over, you know, what the hell are you allowing to happen? What are you doing here? And guess what? You know what Bedelia does? This time she's the one to quote, what's his name? Goethe, the one that Hannibal enjoys quoting all the time. When she says the phrase, "Who holds the devil? Let him hold him well." And then she mentions he will hardly be caught a second time. She's quoting Faust now. And when Will makes it clear that he's not intending that to happen, meaning, you know, they think they're going to be able to kill him, she actually goes with the more tried and true phrase, "Can't live with him, can't live without them." Which I know it's not, but I like to say, "Hey, call out to The Shining." You know, but she asks if that's what this is, and he kind of just says something really nasty to her about, you know, better prepare because meat's back on the menu. So that's when she kind of lashes out at him, calling him a righteous, reckless, twitchy little man. You might as well cut all of our throats and be done with it. So when we come back after another, you know, commercial break to, you know, lower our pulses, speaking of little men, we have Alana visiting Frederick Chilton in what I guess is a hyperbolic chamber. And we find out that he is holding her just as responsible as Will and Hannibal. I think he actually refers to her as the roper for Will. And I don't, he's not referring to Three's Company. He's referring to someone who actually, you know, ropes in the calf or the prey or whatever the phrase is here. Because he's wondering who is she going to rope in for Will now? And when she says it's going to be Hannibal, it's almost kind of like a painful effort for him to not laugh at that. You know, he's clearly amused by the notion, especially when he says he wouldn't mind having some of Hannibal's skin grafted to him. Because it's kind of clear when you take a look at him, his life for the next several months is going to consist of different types of skin grafts. And despite the fact that Chilton's situation is, you know, both horrible and tragic, and yeah, she should bear, I would say, a significant responsibility here, as Lecter even asserted to her last week, Alana still feels the need to say something that kind of sort of smells like a little bit of a burn. Yeah, pun intended. When she tells him, "You were never comfortable in your own skin, Frederick. You won't be comfortable in Hannibal's." I was like, geez, that's the epitome of kicking a guy when he's down. But, you know, he doesn't let it go because he actually says, "Are you?" And by that, I guess the question is she comfortable knowing the part that she's played here and continuing to play? You know, depending how you look at it, she's a puppet for these men, which I don't think she believes herself to be, or maybe that she's become just as much of a monster as Lecter and to a certain degree Will, you know, not to mention other monsters she's encountered like Mason Berger and such. But it doesn't matter. Chilton's lipless words fall on deaf ears because we next see Alana presenting that deal to Hannibal. By the way, I thought it was kind of interesting, this entire act, Alana's at the center of each scene. So I kind of like that she got such a huge part in this final episode, kind of showing how significant a character she'd finally become this season. I like how when she's presenting the deal to Hannibal, it always seems to come down to the books. And I kept thinking, you know, we've seen enough to know that this is taking place in modern day at this point. You know, why not just give him a Kindle? Instead of putting in like 1,000 books. But I digress. I guess she mostly tells him the truth. You know, point, you know, how the Red Dragon faked his death. Now we're going to fake your escape. We're going to put you in police custody. And once again, he does note how well that worked out for Chilton. How he do let Frederick know I wish him a speedy convalescence, and I hope he doesn't turn out too ugly. But Hannibal then points out what's so amazingly obvious. How can everyone not be thinking this? Basically, what if he decides to escape for real? You know? Alana might be first on his hit list. I mean, she certainly believes that. And, you know, from the sound of it, her wife and kid might not necessarily be safe either. He makes a nice little, a Rumpelstiltskin analogy with her here. But he makes a point that as far as he's concerned, and maybe the world should be concerned, she's been dead ever since she decided to be brave in his kitchen all those years ago, and she's been living on borrowed time ever since. I would say this is actually one of the few moments for Hannibal Lecter where he actually comes off as being deliberately threatening when it looks like he's really going out of his way to try to throw a bit of a scare into somebody.
Yeah, he was being a lot more aggressive than we normally see him.
Yeah, and even the camera move where it kind of pans, we're kind of looking up at him, and the ceiling above him kind of gives him this kind of this more. He's got so much presence, I don't think he needs more presence, quite frankly, but it does kind of add just that little something to it. And then the final scene of the act is, again, Alana rejoining the trio, the Graham, Crawford, and Bloom, you know, law firm here. And it turns out that Hannibal did have one more condition, that he wants Will to be the one to ask him and to say please. Huh. Apparently it's not a problem, and they all have a big drink of, what the hell are we doing? I guess they discuss striving for some form of authenticity, which, to be honest, that's pretty tough when you're about to move forward with a plan that's pretty much bonkers. So, yeah, why not let people freak out or what's the phrase? Oh, stampede, I think is the word they keep using when they hear of Lecter's escaping. Oh, yeah, let Will be the scapegoat for it. I'm sure his family won't mind all that because it turns out this plan is supposed to result not only in the killing of Francis Dolarhyde, but Hannibal as well. So everybody's operating outside and beyond the law. I mean, I get it. Maybe it's like they all work in Italy or something now. But as we know, because we've watched the show for the last few years, it's a pretty sure bet this plan is going to work out just fine, just the way all of Will and Jack's plans do. And, oh, by the way, at this point, I was already kind of patting myself on the back a little bit because last week I assumed that Dolarhyde was the lamb. Although, I guess it could still apply to Will at this point in the episode. Maybe it's both of them, but I'm still going to say it's Francis Dolarhyde was the lamb. But I also started thinking, wait a minute, could my completely joking predicted ending actually come true, that Hannibal is free and Bedelia is the friend he's having for dinner? But I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but you know, I did make that joke last week. But the very next scene, I would say, should have been, if these people had a sense of sanity about them, it should have been a jet plane loaded up with all of Hannibal's potential victims, all getting the hell out of town, just leaving town together. You know, Bedelia, Alana, everybody. Put Chilton in the cargo bay, whatever. They should all get the hell out of town. But, of course, you know, that doesn't happen just yet. So, when we come back, we're at Hannibal's churchy memory palace again. And then Hannibal makes a smart-ass comment about what Will said when they had their goodbyes, or that little bit about rejecting them. And it's such an odd line for Hannibal, although funny, just, it's not, once again, it's one of these, I don't expect words like that to come out of Hannibal Lecter's mouth, when he says, I believe that's what they call a mic drop. You dropped the mic, Will, but here you are having to come back and pick it up again. And I'm like, Hannibal just said, made a reference to dropping the mic. And the only thing he needed to say more, I was like, boom. And I realized, wait, didn't he do that in another episode too, actually?
He did.
But, you know, Will is there to ask him for help. And he describes the beginnings of this plan of how Hannibal would escape. And I guess contact Dalaran through a personal ad. Although, I gotta be honest, I'm not clear how Dalaran would even know to look for such an ad. So how does that plan come to fruition? I don't get it.
I was just assuming Will told them what to do, but like, you know, everybody else that, you know, would, you know, like Jack and all those people, like, I don't know why they would make that connection, and Dalaran would just find out.
Yeah, I additionally think that whatever Will is saying here, Will knows is total bullshit. Whether or not he cares or knows that Lecter knows that, I don't know. Again, I have to believe there's cameras on around there filming this, because there should be, because there always has been. So it's also to cover his story for anyone else, I would guess. He also describes, I guess, this mail drop being in a place that would be, at least appear to be safe for any observers, a.k.a., you know, Francis Dalaran. But I like that Hannibal says something which I was thinking during this. He says, you know, this still all sounds kind of weak to you, even as you say. And I was like, wait, the plan is weak? No. But when Will says please, that brings a little bit of a smirk to Lecter's face. And then we see that big cop car caravan rolling down the road. There was that moment, I mean, it was very brief on screen. I think it's when they're passing all those, what do you call it? I guess they're like, I don't know if they're electrical towers or telephone wire towers.
Yeah, it's definitely seven.
Yeah, I thought of seven for a second there. I was like, you know, he's, you know, especially, the only thing is that if they'd had Hannibal making little comments during that moment, then it totally would have been like seven. Huh. But they didn't go that far. He had his mask on and chose not to say anything. And yes, we do see him with the mask and the straitjacket on, and he's in this little cage in the back of one of the vans. And I think probably just at the moment that everyone watching was thinking, wait, so how and when is this escape supposed to happen? Something happens that I don't know if it was according to anyone's plan, or at the very least, I'm pretty sure it wasn't according to Jack's plan. Where Dalaran drives up in a cop car. So let's assume he's already killed at least one cop to get that car. I'll go on that assumption. And he pretty much starts executing every single cop around. I think he probably doubled his entire previous body count all in this one scene. What happens is the van that Will and Hannibal are in ends up breaking really suddenly because it smacks into the lead car, because all the cops in it are dead now. They get sent flying. Will smacks his head. And for some reason, we get this brief shot inserted of Francis Dalaran. I think it's the moment that Will saw him at the museum. I'm not sure why that shot was inserted there, but okay. Let it go. Not sure. And then Will is kind of fading in and out here. So we're fading in and out of black, and we're seeing these blurry flashes of, well, I guess Francis Dalaran pretty much killing everybody else, as well as opening up the cage for Lecter. And then we see Lecter stepping out, tossing aside the mask, and, you know, stripping off the straitjacket. If they had a silly sense of humor on the show, they should have started playing, you know, Born Free or something. As free as the wind blows. But I guess they assume that Dalaran has left them alive because, what is it Lecter says? Oh, what he wants to do to them would require more privacy. I'm going to say that may be true, but it's also, you know what? It would be kind of difficult for him to subdue and then drag both of them into a car and get away before the reinforcements show up. So then again, who knows? Like I said, this guy just killed, you know, he killed anywhere from 8 to 12 cops just now, you know, not even working up a sweat. So he's suddenly becoming, you know, like super duper serial killer. So who knows what he can do. But I guess the fresh air is probably the first he's gotten in 3 years plus. It seems to agree with Hannibal because he's in remarkably fun and fine spirits. You know, I like that he calmly tells Will that he should relax, you know, while he's casually yanking a body out of a cop car and then driving over to him and then pushing the other body out. He says, you know, a little flirty, going my way. What the hell is going on here? But day becomes night. And then we see Jack and the FBI are surveying the carnage. And that look on Jack's face, about looking none too pleased, that's what I was wondering, if he was already thinking that Will might have set him up here, that Will was in on this plan himself. Or maybe he's just reacting to the fact that he's now pretty much somewhat responsible for the death of many police officers. Again, you didn't see this coming? You didn't see this possibility? How, Jack Crawford, are you keeping your badge? How does that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel like he's at the point where he like doesn't even really like give a shit anymore. He just, you know, he doesn't care about the consequences to anything around him.
Oh, yeah. I think he's just, while his obsession is nowhere near the level of Will Graham's sort of obsession, he has gotten to the point where, you know, rules be damned. And in a way, it kind of echoes the Italian inspector from the first half of the season, who had probably at one point in his career been a respected inspector, but now he's just become obsessed with doing this and not really caring. He actually did care about how people perceived him until the end, where he went for the money. So that'll teach the kids something. At this point, we do see that Alana and her family are going to get the hell out of town. And, you know, we see that they're surrounded by bodyguards. And I guess that's pretty much going to be the case for the rest of their lives. But, you know, it was nice to see their kid. And we got a little brief peek at Margot. It was at that moment I realized, you know, outside of maybe, I guess, Will's wife and, you know, and kid and Freddie Lounds, they really packed everybody into this episode, and it didn't feel that way. You know, right. Everyone felt like they were there but had a purpose. And I couldn't really think of a reason to have Freddie Lounds in the episode, so, you know, it's just as well. I will confess, I did wonder if we would get one scene of Will's wife and kid, because, you know, even, I guess maybe they thought there's already so much foreshadowing going on throughout this episode. Having Will do anything that might even remotely seem like a goodbye to her might be just too much and just give it away totally. But it did seem strange that, you know, as we know what happens by the end of the episode, that he does all this without even saying goodbye to his family or acknowledging them, you know, other than earlier in the episode about wanting to go back to them. So I'm not going to say it's a mistake or even a flaw. It was just curious. You know? But instead of his actual family, Will ends up with his murder husband. And I guess it's Hannibal's cliffside retreat, which looks down upon the ocean. Had we seen this place before? I mean, I don't think we'd ever seen the exterior to that extent, but even like the interiors before, had we seen that place before? Because he mentions this is where he had been with Abigail Hobbs and Miriam Less, but I wonder if he's just telling us that, but we'd never actually seen it before. Do you recall it by any chance?
No, but it's been a while since I watched season one, so I'm just assuming that they showed it like earlier, maybe like Will and Jack ate there at one point or something. It just seems like a long time.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing, I know the exteriors were never shown before because in some of my reading post-episode, I read about how they composed that shot, that they're, you know, the actual house is one place, but they actually had to get a cliffside from somewhere else and merge the two images together to create the cliffside kind of
right
look. So, by the way, the fact I have to say it again, they're on a mountainside, on a cliffside. So, again, one of the jokes I made on this podcast about maybe Hannibal will end up on a mountainside or something. I was referencing Mad Men. I was like, oh, wow. All these little things I said are kind of starting to shape up to maybe actually happen here. Freaky. And before they cut to commercial, I like that Hannibal notes that the bluff is still eroding. And yeah, you can say he's talking about the cliffside, you know, which is the bluff, which is eroding. But it also feels more like a metaphor for all these shenanigans that they've both been up to. You know, their own bluff is pretty much eroding at this point. And then we get to the home stretch, the final act. And we're back at the Hannibal hideaway. And, you know, Will is at the window. He's contemplating the M-O-O-N. That spells moon. Actually, that spells warped bromance. And Hannibal has switched from, you know, that straight jacket we saw him in earlier. Now he's got a sports jacket on. Although I think it's a bit more of a subdued ensemble than his usual civilian attire. I guess maybe because Alana now has the corner on all the really flashy and sporty outfits, which is, I bet, the reason why Hannibal really has her atop his kill list. Anyway,
I wouldn't. I'm not sure why this Hannibal's place would still be sitting there like that after a few years, but you know.
You wonder if there was dust anywhere, or if he had someone still coming in on a payroll, and it was because they showed like his office and his where I assume he usually lived, and that had like sheets all over everything, you know. But this seemed to be fun. But then again, we move forward in time, so for all we know, he took the sheets off of everything when they entered. I don't know.
Yeah.
I was talking with a couple of friends. They were kind of wondering, where the heck is this place? Because, you know, most of the episodes tend to take place in, you know, whether it be Baltimore, Maryland, or wherever the FBI kind of comes out. Where is there a place with a cliffside like this? But I guess there has to be. I don't remember. I confess, I do not remember if Lecter has a home like this mentioned in the books. I tend to doubt it because we didn't get that much detail about him. So I'm going to say they might have concocted this for the show, unless it's in a later book and I'm just totally forgetting it. And if I am, I don't really care.
Yeah, but definitely, they said it was the Atlantic Ocean, so. But as to whether, you know, I suppose maybe up towards Maine and stuff like that, they might have something with that kind of, you know, relief on the cliffs. But
yeah, although that would be one hell of a drive. So
yeah.
You'd think they were driving somewhere within at least a few hours. So I don't know. Again, it becomes one of those things that, you know, added to the list of, I could question that, but I'm going to choose not to. There are things that will happen in these final minutes that most people will like, I kind of want to question that, but I'm just going to let it go because that's the nature of this show. So they're having this little conversation where they're discussing, they're discussing their respective meetings with the Great Red Dragon, although obviously Lecter's were not in person, and then the actual planned murder of Hannibal Lecter. I think this is the point where Hannibal actually says that his compassion for Will has been inconvenient. And then after he pours a couple glasses of wine, you know, you wouldn't have an episode of Hannibal without him quoting something, you know? But Bedelia already quoted Hannibal's favorite go-to guy, you know, go-to Goethe. So instead, Hannibal says that no greater love hath man than to lay down his life for a friend. Yeah, Hannibal went to like the most quotable thing ever, the Bible, you know? And based on the political news in recent days, maybe Trump can say that's his favorite passage. But maybe in some sort of twisted divine retribution, you know, kind of pretty much seconds after he's quoting scripture here, Lecter is shot. And, you know, they both were just saying they knew that Francis Dolarhyde was out there watching them. So I'm not quite sure what old Hanny here was thinking, standing by the window the way he was. But anyway, he shot, you know, like through the back, out through his abdominal area. It pretty much is the sort of place that if this was a normal man, he'd probably be dead within a few minutes, you know, bleeding out from a gut wound like this. But we have to remember, you know, we're on our 39th episode now. This is the series where pretty much everyone seems to be able to survive clearly mortal wounds.
Yeah, I think somehow they all ended up with Wolverine's healing factor.
Right, because if you think about it, Chilton's got the whole Wile E. Coyote thing. He should have been dead a few times. You know, Crawford should have been dead after having his throat slashed the way it was last year. How many times has Will, like, yeah, you're dead. Yeah, you're dead. Yeah, you're dead. He keeps coming back to life. How did Abigail Hobbs die exactly? In fact, shouldn't she have been dead? Then she came back and then she died again or something?
Yes.
And, you know, and Alana, you know, thrown out, whatever. It's one of those things where you kind of got to let it go. And again, especially after what happens over the next couple minutes. Because, you know, Dollar-Eyed walks in through the shattered glass door. He's got that big gun and silencer. I like that he warns Will to stay put, you know, if he runs, he'll catch him, which is exactly what he said to Reva earlier. But, you know, Will, at this point, seems like he's going to follow orders. He's going to actually drink his wine while Dollar-Hyde is about to finish off Lecter. And what's really important about this scene, well, other than the fact it's one of the final scenes of the series, is that this is the first real time that Dollar-Hyde and Lecter are meeting face-to-face, not their imagined conversations when they're actually on the phone or what have you. And damned if Lecter doesn't go right into manipulative therapist mode with him. But it's kind of funny that Dollar-Hyde is just so focused on what he's about to do, which is basically filming the death of Adam Lecter, you know, so he gets absorbed into the Great Red Dragon or something, that whatever Lecter is saying isn't really having an effect on him. Now, at this moment, Dollar-Hyde takes out this really small but nasty-looking knife. It looks like the kind of thing you gut an animal with because it's such a short blade. And there's that brief look that's exchanged between Lecter and Will. And then you see Will is about to reach for a gun that he has in the back of his waistband. And that's where the shit goes crazy. Because Dollar-Hyde attacks him and basically jams the knife right into the side of his face and flings him outside. If I'm not mistaken, although most of this episode is them doing their own thing, in the ultimate climax of the book, Red Dragon, I'm pretty sure that Francis Dollar-Hyde also stabs Will in the face pretty savagely. So that one, at least there is that one little thing they do have in common. Except he doesn't have his wife here to save his ass this time. He has his husband. Because, you know, Francis Dollar-Hyde goes after him, and, you know, Will rips the knife out of his cheek, and then he jams it in Dollar-Hyde's leg. And then Dollar-Hyde takes the same knife and stabs Will in the chest. I like how everyone just keeps sticking a knife in other people and just leaving it there. So everyone just keeps using it for everything. You know, it's already, so that knife, whatever it costs, it's paid for itself in bloodshed at this point. But at this point, I keep saying at this point, sorry about that, Lecter has removed that, what I like to call his Alex P. Keaton jacket. He attacks Dollar-Hyde from behind. Dollar-Hyde flips him over. But as he's approaching Lecter, you know, we see he has those huge dragon wings. But I think for the first time, it's not just in his own mind, because it's pretty clear from what I'll call the human pincushion for knives, Will Graham, he can see the wings as well. Based that on his reaction as he's walking away, I think. So Dollar-Hyde, he lifts Lecter up, he's strangling him, and then Will attacks the dragon again. He stabs him twice in the kidneys with that knife again. I don't know why they keep leaving that knife in. It's not a very long blade. But, you know, Dollar-Hyde drops Lecter to fight off Will, and Hannibal just happens to land next to a very conveniently placed axe. And at that moment, the soundtrack, and, you know, as much like our podcast, the soundtrack tend to be classical music, maybe with a little bit of opera mixed in here and there. But we get a song. And we get a song that was especially written and sung for the show and for this episode by the singer Sushi Sue, who is better known as the lead singer from the incredibly influential and highly regarded alternative and punk band from the 80s, Sushi and the Banshees. This song that we hear on the soundtrack, and hopefully we'll hear on the podcast, maybe right now, who knows, it's called Love Crime. It's actually her first new song written in like 8 years. So that's pretty cool that the show got that to happen. And the song itself, it kind of felt very lush and haunting. It felt almost like a really great James Bond song or something.
So yeah, it's better than the last like 20 of them. So,
although I did like the Adele song from the last one, yeah. I did like that one. But I'm gonna say this may be one of the best songs I've heard at the end of a finale since probably Sia's "Breathe Me," which was at the end of Six Feet Under. I know you haven't seen it, but it's very famous. Trust me. So as that song is playing, you know, Will and Hannibal, they kind of form their own little operatic combo with, you know, one with a knife, one with the axe. But forget their weapons of destruction here. Undoubtedly the killing blow came right out of Rick Grimes' playbook when Hannibal shows the Great Red Dragon how you really take a bite out of somebody, because he rips out his throat. At this point, with all these wounds, blood is spurting and spouting and splashing everywhere. It was kind of reminding me a little bit of last season's finale. Only as much as I think we both love that finale, what made this one even more impressive is it felt that much more cinematic. I mean, I felt like I was watching a movie and it just happened to be at home or something. It just had that kind of feel to it. But with that killing blow, as I mentioned, Dollarhide collapses to the ground. And then we see like the blood kind of running out of him and along the cracks of the stones. And Yuri knew where they were going with this. I think it was pretty obvious. But, you know, then we flash to what I guess are his last thoughts and memories. And we see him burning his scrapbook and I would guess his entire home for that matter. And there's this one really breathtaking shot of his silhouette kind of framed in flames. And you see all the film strips all billowing all around him, almost like the, I don't know, like the skeletal tendrils or something, or bone structure of his wings perhaps. And then we dissolve back to him dying. And you see that all the blood that's puddled all around him kind of looks like it's formed, you know, blood wings, you know, that are framing his corpse. So it's artistic, but it works, and it's really it's bloody and gorgeous all at once. Now, this whole sequence, you know, this ballet of, you know, violence and blood, I kind of thought it was just as brutal, if not more so, than any Peckinpah or Tarantino kind of a thing. It lasts about 3 minutes. So I was trying to think about this, at least in recent years, if there had been a more memorable death of essentially like a psychopathic killer in the last few years. You know, I started thinking of other ones, and I don't think any of them come close to this. You know, because, you know, we don't really get to see, you know, Lauren Malvo killed in Fargo. I think we cut away from it, if I recall. And I didn't really think that much of the actual death of the Errol the lawnmower guy from like that first season of True Detective, you know. Although I think when we watched that final episode of that first season, that kind of reminded us a little bit of Hannibal to begin with, quite frankly. But in this scene, the fact that Brian Fuller decided to have Francis Dolarhyde and Hannibal Lecter go mano a mano, I actually had the silly thought that it was almost like you're staging one of those classic Universal Studio monster fights, you know, like Frankenstein versus the Wolfman, or maybe like a King Kong versus Godzilla kind of thing. What I loved about this is that it shows that, you know, just how good a version of the Red Dragon story he and his fellow writers concocted for us, that they could diverge so much away from the books. And yet, by the time we get to the end here, it doesn't just feel right. It felt inevitable, like it had to come down to this sort of ending, you know, with these two joining together to kill Dollarhyde. It was kind of like the consummation of their relationship, you know, so it had to end with Dollarhyde, you know, dead at their feet.
I think they really did a good job at like adapting the Red Dragon story to their fitting into their narrative without just like jamming it in there in some, you know, square hole, round peg or whatever sort of way.
Yeah.
And I didn't get the impression that like, you know, there was a lot of like big fans of the book like you that were pissed off about anything they did either.
No, I can and I would tell you if there was, because as much as I've clearly liked the series or even loved the series, I'd already said it in our first Hannibal podcast, it's like my favorite book, you know, or if not my favorite book, it's definitely top three. You know, if I want to pick a more highfalutin book to be number one, like Animal Farm or something. But back to the episode, this little blood-soaked bromance, it isn't over yet. And I like that, you know, they're both staggering, they're weakened from the fight, and then I'm guessing between the two of them, they've probably both lost several pints of blood at this point, which again, seems to be fine. You know, no one ever collapses from blood loss, except for, I guess, Dalaran, maybe. But Hannibal does say to Will that this is all I ever wanted for you, you know, for both of us. So it's this interesting, I don't want to call it a sweet moment because that's not really the right word here, but I genuinely believe Hannibal's sincerity here, that he viewed Will. Will's probably the closest he's ever seen anyone to being an equal to him, I would say. You know, because you can imagine Hannibal thinks of most people as being, you know, well, cattle, quite frankly, you know, hence all his cannibalism and whatever. I'm sorry, go on.
It's kind of like the same feeling you have when like we have a really good podcast. You're just like, ah, I guess this Dan guy's okay. I thought he was cattle like the rest of them, but I guess this kind of worked out.
It depends on how participatory you are in the podcast, how weakened you are from, I guess not blood loss, but energy loss from working a 15 and a half hour shift or whatever, the kind of things you end up doing. But where was I? Right. The consummation of the relationship and him thinking, viewing Will as close to an equal as he's ever had. And although I believe Hannibal did, let's put it crassly, perhaps get off on having Bedelia be, as he puts it, and then she also puts it, participatory in his crimes. And I think he was even going in that direction with Abigail as well, and did go in that direction, actually, now that I think about it. But having Will combine forces with him and both, you know, murder someone in this fashion, it felt like they were finally in that same place together. And when Will responds to him saying it's beautiful, I'm going to say I don't think Will is just saying that to do what he's about to do, you know, a few seconds later. I think Will, this part of Will, that does actually believe that, because I think Will has been afraid that he has become more like Lecter, or he has become attracted to that sort of violent nature, or, you know, or dominance, or whatever, however you want to look at it. I did think for just a moment here, and I was thinking, wow, is Brian Fuller not just going to push the envelope, but freaking rip it up altogether? I actually thought they were going to kiss for a second there. There's that one moment, yeah. Like, oh, are they going to do that? Because, you know what? I actually would have applauded them getting away with that, because I think they might have been able to justify it. You know, and that's saying something considering how much I care for the book, but that would have been something. But instead, they embrace each other. And I got to say, in an episode filled with beautifully composed shots, and this series as a whole, you know, however you look at it, even when they went really way, perhaps over the top artsy fartsy, this image of them embracing on the cliffside, and if anyone can go back and study this moment in the film, I should say, I would say this is the look, the feel, the composition of this. It's as gorgeous as anything photographed by Annie Leibovitz, or any frame of film from a David Fincher or Paul Anderson, or choose your director of the day moment. It just looks striking. It forget not looking like something you see on network TV. I thought this looked better than anything I would even see on cable TV. I mean, I don't think I've seen anything that looked that nice on HBO, quite frankly, including your Game of Thrones or whatever. I really admire this shot.
It's wonderful. They really had their shit together.
Yeah, I would even go. I even get a little goofy here. Actually, maybe I just had a little bit of a head rush because I realized I'm in the last bit of the episode. But I actually felt a little dizzy, which, guess what, turned out to be bizarrely appropriate because 2 seconds later, Will tightens his arms around Lecter and he takes them both over the cliff. And what I loved about how they shot that is it's almost as if the camera, possibly like Lecter himself, seems to be somewhat surprised as well, because it's like the camera takes a thing like, wait, what just happened? And then follows them over the edge, but you know, they're nowhere to be seen. We just see the crashing waves below. So we're left in this one moment as the credits start to roll, not knowing if they could have survived such a huge fall. I mean, it's a huge fall. I mean, not to mention all the possible rocks and everything, but you don't know, did they just do a Thelma and Louise? Or maybe this is Butch Cassidy and Sundance. I think the thing that really came to mind, and this is a bit more of a literary thing, although it has been done on screen back in the day, and I'm not going to, was the original famous combo of hero and villain, Holmes and Moriarty, back in the 1890s when Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote the story, I think it's, what was it called? The Final Solution. He has them falling to their death at Reichenbach Falls. I think in the actual story, we don't see it, even though I think there's a drawing of it, but Watson figures it out because he sees obviously a battle has happened at this cliffside and he realizes that they've died and gone over the edge. Although several years later, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle brought Holmes back from the dead because, you know, you can do that. Plus, I think the most common, let's bring someone back from the dead, is when they fall into the sea. Whether it be soap operas or comic books or movies, that's usually your go-to. Oh yeah, they can still be alive. We can bring them back. And I gotta say, that's pretty much probably what happens here, because they had fun again, just like with last year's finale, where we stayed with the credits. But we got a little treat, little post-credit scene of Bedelia wearing quite the little outfit. She's seated at this lavishly set dinner table, and you see the places are set. I think there were actually two additional place settings, not just one, but there's at least one. But we see the main entree on the table. Looks pretty human. If you look at it like that's a leg. And then the camera moves under the table, and then to reveal that Bedelia is actually getting the same slow death treatment that Eddie Izzard's Dr. Gideon got, well, in Showtime a few years ago, but in our time, this is what we saw flashes of earlier in the season. So it's actually in a way coming full circle, except now he's doing it to someone else, because Bedelia is down one leg, as we discover. But, and I believe there might have been some speculation by regular viewers or even some TV critics who thought it could be possible that she might have done this to herself. I'm going to go out on a limb, out on a limb, and say no. Plus, we also see her grabbing a fork and hiding it there under the table, like she's waiting for someone to come back in the room that she could possibly stab. So I don't think she did this to herself, because cutting off your own leg, that's not easy. And I don't think she's waiting for like an imaginary person to show up with a fork for who knows how long. But I thought that was quite the kicker of the end, because you go from, you know, what could be considered a literal cliffhanger, but I think an ending that would be fine for the series. Like, oh, and then they die. And then we get the little, or maybe not. So, and that was it. That, and I prefer to phrase it as that was the NBC series finale of Hannibal, because I'm still harboring some hope of something down the road. So, yeah, and you know, we've talked about previous episodes, and I've said A or A might. I gotta say, I'm doing it. I'm slapping the A plus on this one. I thought it was one of the best episodes I've ever seen of the series, period. So I thought it was a fantastic end to the series.
Nice. Well, you're definitely having a good string of final episodes of shows that we actually care about ending, so, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. And some of the amazing stuff about this episode is like learning afterwards that they only spent 8 days filming this episode. And knowing how long it can take just to film things, like, you know, especially when you have something that looks like a movie, and movies can spend 8 days on 2 minutes of film, quite frankly. And other shows, yeah, they film episodes within that number of days, but they're much easier setup pieces. But like they said, they filmed that entire final sequence. They did that all in a day. I think they said in less than 10 hours, I read somewhere. That's unexpectedly quick for such a scene. You know, that's pretty amazing, because that's almost the entire act there as well.
And you consider all the, like, different stuff they have to do in this episode, too. You know, like, even, you know, like, the car scene and all this other stuff. That's a lot of shit.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts. They didn't have quite as much time as one would think to even rehearse the fight scenes and stuff. And yeah, think about how much time they had to spend choreographing this, but then like also choreographing all the stuff with killing all those cops and all that stuff. It's really an impressive, it becomes that much more an impressive piece of work when you realize that. Now, since I made a reference to, you know, future Hannibal stuff, I'll just take the words right from Brian Fuller's mouth of what he said this weekend. He basically, to quote him, he said, "The fans are going to have to be very patient. It's going to be at least a year before anything will get greenlit." But he does mention that series stars, you know, Mikkelsen and Dancy, are both excited about his vision. And the executive producer, Martha De Laurentiis, is currently trying to find financing for, at the very least, a film, if not a longer piece. So I feel that something will happen. It's just, it may be a couple years down the line, but like we were joking last week, you know, in an era where things like the X-Files and Twin Peaks and all the hero, even crap like Heroes and whatever, can all come back, you know, a few to several years later, I have every reason to believe that, you know, this can as well. I mean, even if it is a movie, even though I would prefer it to at least be a miniseries of some sort, because I would rather see them use long form than just do, like, you know, a movie, what would be like a movie remake or something like that. Which then brings me to the other thing I was reading about, which I was excited, even if none of it will ever happen. Brian Fuller actually revealed what he had in mind as far as a Silence of the Lambs-based season. He made it clear that he would want to feature all the characters, you know, that you can think of from Silence of the Lambs, you know, everybody. Not just Clarice Starling. I mean, Clarice Starling's, you know, roommate, you know? Like, everyone you can imagine. I mean, while they would bring back the Miriam Last character, character that's played by Anna Chlumsky, who some people felt was maybe a stand-in for Clarice. He basically, no, they would want to get the rights to Clarice Starling. They would want to use that character. Casting-wise, he said in a couple of different interviews that the first person he has in mind for the role would be Ellen Page. I'm hoping he's not saying Ellen Page because she might share a certain sexual nature with Jodie Foster, but just because he thinks she would be a good choice. But then he also mentioned he's thought about maybe going in an entirely different direction, racially speaking. So maybe he would cast, say, like an African-American actress, which would not be unprecedented because He did the same thing with both Reba McLean's character and Jack Crawford. These are both characters that had always been Caucasians before, and in this series, they were black. Here's the one I thought was really interesting. He said he would like to see Lee Pace for the Buffalo Bill role. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then he went on to say that he actually had wanted to get Lee Pace to play Francis Dolarhyde, but he had to wait to see if Halt and Catch Fire was going to get picked up or not, as far as whether he'd be available. So as we know, at the time, it did get picked up. But, you know, I think Richard Armitage did such a great job. I don't think he lost anything by having him take the part.
No, but...
And lastly, he also does mention that, you know, since he did play such a key role in the books, Chilton would be back and at this point be likely in charge. He would just be really, really horribly disfigured. So, you know, who knows? You know, like we pointed out, you know, shows do come back, whether it be for a whole season or just a special movie or two. But they all have all these projects going on. So, but I prefer to believe there's still at least a chance at some point in the distant future we will see Mads Mikkelsen as Lecter again.
Yeah, well, you know, and like you said, if they made this in 8 days, I mean, they could make a 2-hour movie in, you know, a month. If, you know, you would think they'd be able to sneak away for a month at some point. So,
right, like absolutely.
Because obviously they know, the production crew really knows what they're doing.
So, you know, it occurs to me then, as we reach this point in the podcast, we've completed talking about this specific episode, but now it's just kind of like looking back at the series. And this, I guess, unless they do come back, this is our last Hannibal podcast, which, you know, a little sad. You know, especially when I realized it turns out that our most downloaded podcast of all 70 or 71 that we've done so far turned out to be our first Hannibal one. So funny how the show that's watched by so few people got the most listeners for us. But, you know, to be serious, and although he'll never hear this, although I will tweet him with the link, so maybe he might listen to it. I would love to just personally thank Brian Fuller himself, because this is a guy, I mean, I would say he's probably been one of the more creative visionaries maybe in the medium of television over the last, you know, 10, 15 years. You know, he started out as a guy, I think, you know, certain Trekkies would appreciate, because he was one of the forces behind Star Trek Voyager. And then, you know, he did shows like, you know, Dead Like Me, but he really started to push it more with shows like Wonderfalls and Pushing Daisies, especially. I love Pushing Daisies. And, you know, even the first season of Heroes, give him credit for that, too. You know, I think we're both looking forward to any future stories that he might have for us with Will and Hannibal and everybody else, I think we're both also eagerly awaiting this version he's doing of American Gods, which, for anyone who doesn't know what that is, that's a novel by the science fiction and comic book writer Neil Gaiman, who's probably best known for the Sandman series of comic books. So, but I've been reading up on this because I myself have not read American Gods, but I'm very aware of it. And I feel like I kind of want to read it ahead of time, but with Brian Fuller doing it, maybe I don't want to be bothered because I just want to see his vision. So, but I'm excited to see that.
Yeah, I should read that sometime, because, I mean, I've read some of his comic stuff, but, like, he does stuff, like, in this area, like, all the time, you know, signings and shit, because he's got a place, like, between me and the Twin Cities. I mean, he's got a place, like, an hour and a half from me, so he does stuff in the Twin Cities a lot.
Wow, excellent.
Yeah.
So, you know, just looking back, I mean, both of us, I mean, over time, we watch a lot of TV. I mean, I know that I probably fall into the category of watching too much TV. You know, if you're spending more time watching TV than sleeping or anything else, you're probably watching too much TV. But over the past few years, you know, I think we've gotten like the best of the medium by far. You know, we've gotten, you know, everything from Breaking Bad, Mad Men, recently, you know, like Rectify or the first season of Fargo. And, you know, and I've been vastly entertained by, you know, shows that we love, like The Fun of the Flash, or being wrapped up in the characters on The Good Wife, or even just like the spectacle of a show like Game of Thrones or something. But Hannibal, probably more than any other show, like even more than like The Flash or Fargo, you know, other, you know, unexpected adaptations for the small screen. It shocked me because I was so skeptical when the show started. You know, that's putting it mildly. And now I'm so sad that it's over is also putting it mildly, because what they accomplished here, and it's not just Brian Fuller, it's everyone involved, you know, they worked over material that had been mined in films and on print and whatever several times over, you know, so like, did anyone really need to go here again? Plus, they're working in the huge shadow of like a pretty much an iconic portrayal by Anthony Hopkins, which most of say is a pretty thankless task, you know, so it's, you know, so therefore it's difficult to create something that's entirely new here. It's difficult to create interest in a property that, let's be honest, it probably met its pop culture relevance expiration date, you know, years earlier. And that may even be why this show never really did well in terms of ratings, because people are like, really? Hannibal Lecter? Who cares about Hannibal Lecter anymore? But from a uniformly fine cast, and let's reiterate that, you know, compared to certain other shows we watch which are good or okay or maybe even overrated, that just about each and every character that was cast on this show brought the goods and left us something to remember. This didn't just come down to just a couple actors and nobody else. I mean, you just look at the last past season, you know, it wasn't just Will Graham and Hannibal Lecter, it's Jack Crawford and Alana Bloom and Frederick Chilton and, you know, Zeller and Price and Bedelia and Mason Verger and Cordell and Margo and even freaking Inspector Pazzi. Oh, and Dollarhide and Reba. I mean, yeah. I wasn't thrilled with Chio, I'll give you that. or the snails, you know. It always comes back to the snails. But out of 39 episodes, I'm fine with living with a couple that maybe felt a little bit needless or dragged on that European vacation a little bit longer than it needed to go. Because once we got to Verger's slaughterhouse, all the way through Dollarhide's Attic of Horrors, it's like what you said before, this series ended as impressively as any that we've seen in recent years. So if this is the and it comes down to the fact that if this is the final time we see Brian Fuller's vision of these characters, I'm fine with that.
And this did something, you know, that the other shows didn't exactly have to do. I mean, this also had to leave, you know, the possibility for more open, you know, the Mad Men, Boardwalk Empire, Breaking Bad, they didn't have to do that. They just were able to, you know, tie us up for, you know, and just be done with it. But, you know, these guys managed to, you know, not only tell a satisfying ending, but also leave it open for, you know, they could jump right into another season easily. And that, I mean, that I can't imagine, you know, just doing a good ending isn't exactly easy, as we've learned. So to be able to, like, have an ending that isn't necessarily an ending, I mean, that's skill.
Yeah, it's the TV version of having your cake and eating it too, because you know, and certain shows have had to do that over the years where they were never sure if they were going to get renewed, so they have an Mad Men actually did that to a slight extent in some earlier seasons before they knew what their plan was going to be, where it could end here, but if we don't end up going any further, and the fact is, if you read. There's been a few interviews with Brian Fuller. Folks can find them. You know, there's one that was in Variety magazine, Variety. So look for that one on Variety.com. There's one with Alan Sepinwall. So go to HitFlix.com and look under what Alan's watching, and you can find the interview there if you look for it. Very in depth, a lot of information there, and he actually talks about the fact that they didn't know at the time when they were filming that it was over. You know, that they didn't get the word from NBC until that episode was pretty much in the can, but they knew. They kind of go on the assumption we're probably not going to get renewed. And even the way NBC was talking to him about other things, I think he used the phrase, I think the writing was on the wall before we were even told. So they definitely wrote the episode with that in mind, like, make sure you write something which can function both ways, that we still have an opening in case we get a fourth season somewhere or what have you. So, yeah, it's threading a needle, and I thought they really did a great job with that. So, absolutely correct about that.
Yeah, I do suspect that, you know, even though nobody bothered watching Hannibal, I'm guessing that, you know, at least us, and, you know, probably a lot of other people we know too, are going to end up being probably more satisfied with the ending of this than we will of shows that, like, everybody watches, like Game of Thrones and, like, The Walking Dead. Those shows just kind of feel like the kind of shows that are going to have, like, a, you know, ending kind of like Lost or Battlestar Galactica. Both endings that I was completely fine with, but definitely, you know, there was plenty of people that weren't, so I don't know what that says, but...
There are certain shows that seem to lend themselves to being more likely to have a polarizing ending than others. And
it might have to do with, like, the, you know, like the people that are watching them too. You know, I mean, it's, you know, this is the kind of show for, I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing there are a lot of people that are just, like, you know, dumb as shit watching Hannibal. So, but you know, it's just, you know, the, you know, shows like Game of Thrones and Walking Dead apply to a, you know, a wider audience. Doesn't necessarily have to be as cerebral to enjoy it. So, I mean, there's definitely room for more kind of a, you know, confusion and, you know, pissy shitheadness about the endings there.
Well, you know, that probably will happen. I mean, we've had a kind of a decent on-again, off-again streak of most shows that we've watched over the last couple of years that we like have actually had great to at least decent endings. You know, we got a couple, you know, everything from, like, from started with Breaking Bad, and we can pretend Dexter didn't exist anyway. But, you know, everything from Boardwalk Empire, Justified, we've gotten some decent endings. Mad Men, of course. We've gotten some endings that we've liked. But the interesting thing about this is they had a blueprint that they could have followed if they had chosen to go a safer route. You know, they could have just followed the book. And
Right. Like
I said, after the first three minutes of the episode, everything that happens after that ain't in the book. And it works fine. Watching what they did, I think in many ways it's a better ending than the book, because the ending of the book at this point in time, because some, you know, a few decades have passed, it feels like a very traditional third act of a horror movie. Oh, the killer comes back and it's a big thing, and then someone just shoots him dead who really isn't the right person to be doing it in the first place. So.
No, but, you know, but that definitely, you know, that is kind of the right kind of ending for that book, you know, that kind of story too. So, I mean, you know,
for that,
wrong with that ending, but they definitely told the, you know, the kind of ending they should have done for this kind of story for here too. So.
Oh, right. And yeah, don't misunderstand. I don't, within 15 minutes of me saying it's, if it's not my favorite book, it's my top three, I'm not going to then be knocking the book. So
yeah. Yes,
makes very little
Red
sense.
Red Dragon, Animal Farm, Mein Kampf. So we got that all.
Ah, boy.
I'm kidding.
Well, now just for that, I'm going. A show that's had its moments of, let's say, being a little bit pretentious at times. You know, I felt it was only appropriate that I actually end the podcast. Wait, should I end the podcast now? No, not yet. Let's say a couple of things. We may or may not be doing any more podcasts for a little while. We may do one or two in September, but we don't have anything specifically lined up. I have an idea for one, but I don't know if we'll get around to doing it.
Yeah, we've both got some ideas for stuff, but I'm a little worn down. We're both a little worn down by the
especially when you figure out that it's possible that we've done like 50 something podcasts in the last 8 months or
it's just funny because, like, you know, that, like, I don't, you know, that I don't use a dumb Facebook memory thing, but, you know, some of my friends are just automatically pops up for them, so then I'll just click it just to see what happened, you know, a year or two ago, whatever. So, you know, I'll click it, and, like, a year ago we'd, like, released episode, like, 11 or 12 or something. I'm just like, what the hell?
Yeah, we might have done a bit of a glut, but we were covering, we were doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But, like I said, we'll probably get together to record at least once or twice in September. We'll probably do at least one with our with our little geek squad, and maybe we'll do a different one as well. I kind of have a suspicion. I have an idea for one that we might do before the Emmys, but I don't know. It depends on if we both have both energy and time.
Yeah.
But I just felt I should make a reference to that because, you know, we don't, our next episode-based TV podcast will probably be in October when we resume talking about The Flash, and we'll probably be packing up with a couple other superhero TV shows as well. So it'll be, I might ease up on the recapping for that, so otherwise it'll be an 18-hour podcast, but hopefully we'll knock off a couple shows in those. And we would like to be able to tackle Fargo as well. I think that would be an enormously entertaining show to podcast about.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm definitely going to last year. I only watched the first one and then got behind due to being busy.
And, yeah.
This time I'll definitely be watching it every week. So.
So that is it on our slate. Of course, as luck would have it, the podcast for all those will end up being delayed because of that. That's the only time remaining in the year where you have available to go on. Is it a major hiking trip or mountain climbing?
Yeah, that's the plan, you know, to go up to the mountains of Wyoming, backpack for a week, but. Yeah. And it happens to be like when Flash and all these Fargo all come back. It's pretty shitty timing, but
it's literally the week that I think if I'm not mistaken, you leave on the day the Flash comes back and you come back on the day the second episode of the Flash. So that means that following week we'll be loading up on we'll get another little podcast glut that week, I guess. But then come back to normal, unless one of us has decided to quit the podcasting game entirely. Who knows? Anything's possible. But I doubt that very much.
Yeah.
So, you know what? This should be the last thing I do. Should I do it now or should I do it after?
Yeah, plug the stuff and then do your poem and then we're done.
There you go. Okay. Right, because of the ending. So, if you enjoy this podcast, you probably enjoy our Facebook page too. So you can find us on Facebook at the Serious TV Drama Podcast, Scott and Dan. You can like the page, join the page, join the conversation about shows like Hannibal, and pretty much we'll talk about any TV show there. Even shows we don't like, we allow to be spoken about there. You know, we might mock them, but we certainly will talk about them.
And if you leave us a 5-star review, maybe I'll buy some crack or something and I can like actually wake up for one of these things, because I've been pretty tired the last few.
Yes, I've been doing the Atlas like routine here, but you know, I understand, because you know, you like Dan does work these incredibly long days into the night sometimes, so, and we quite often record pretty late at night as well, so the fact he's even able to switch on his mic is kind of impressive at this point. But when he mentioned a 5-star review, he's actually referring to when you find us on iTunes. If you search for us on iTunes, just punch in Serious TV Drama, that'll find us. You can subscribe to us there as well as rate and review us if you like us. If you don't like us, you can leave it alone. One more thing. We finally have our own Twitter account. So you can find us on Twitter and follow us there. Our Twitter handle is, it's a nice simple one for a change. It's STVD Podcast. Or should I say, are the kids say at STVD Podcast? Do I need to say the at? It doesn't matter. Anyway, we want to rack up the followers there so that when I'm sending out the podcast or any other tweets or messages, y'all can get those as well. And I think that covers all the plugs. I wish I had written all that down ahead of time so it could have been a bit more professional.
Yeah, it's fine.
Whatever, it's fine. It's late. So I wanted to end this podcast, and I know it sounds a little dorky, but I wanted to end the podcast with a poem. And it's a poem by the most quoted writer on the series other than Thomas Harris himself, Hannibal's favorite writer, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. And he actually has a poem called The Farewell. So I guess I Should I just read it now and that'll close out the podcast?
Yep.
Okay, then. And I will not do this in a German accent, don't worry.
Oh, I was hoping you would.
I was thinking about it, actually. Let mine eye the farewell say, that my lips can utter ne'er. Fain I'd be a man today, yet 'tis hard, oh hard to bear. Mournful in an hour like this is love's sweetest pledge, I ween. Cold upon thy mouth the kiss, faint thy fingers' pressure e'en. Oh, what rapture to my heart used each stolen kiss to bring, as the violet's joy impart gathered in the early spring. Now no garlands I entwine, now no roses pluck for thee. Though 'tis springtime, Fanny mine, dreary autumn 'tis to me.
I'll survive. Leave. Wrestling.